I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Tea and Murder, an Agatha Christie podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Tundy Norman. We're part book club, part interview show, and all Agatha Christie. I just want to thank our guest, Dr. Mark Aldridge, for rescheduling this episode. As our listeners know, there was a little health issue for me, and we are now so happy to be back. Thank you to all of you for being patient, and especially thanks to you, Dr. Aldridge. This is our last episode of the season. Thank you so much for tuning in for season two. We have a really, really great season three coming up, so get ready for that. And now let's get into the interview. I am so excited to have here with me Dr. Mark Aldridge. He is an Agatha Christie historian and speaker. His books include Agatha Christie's Marple, Expert on Wickedness, Agatha Christie's Poirot, The Greatest Detective in the World, and Agatha Christie on Screen. Mark recently launched the podcast The Swinging Christies, Agatha Christie in the 1960s, with writer Gray Robert Brown. And it is so much fun. If you haven't listened yet, I'm sure you all have. Definitely tune into that. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, thank you for having me on. Very excited, especially about the book that we're talking about today.
Me too. I'm so excited to talk about that. Before that, we're going to talk about you, baby. So tell me a little bit about your relationship to Agatha Christie's work and when you started reading her books.
I've read her books for a very long time, like most people. One of those, you know, if you're an Agatha Christie fan, you tend to be a fan from when you're, a child.
In the womb,
and my mum, still an Agatha Christie fan.
Yeah.
And so Agatha Christie was just around all of the time. But I was a huge reader. It's so embarrassing to think about how much I read as a child compared to how much I read now, because you just couldn't stop me from reading. Like, you know how you take video games off children to punish them now? Mm-hmm. Now, you know, for me, that equivalent punishment would be you can't keep reading books. You know, that's how much that I was reading books.
Right.
So Agatha Christie was one of the first adult authors, you know, authors who wrote for adults that I really engage with. But
yeah.
We loved sort of the adaptations and everything at home as well. So for me, it's all one big thing. And I can't really remember the order in which I read them all, but
yeah.
Definitely Agatha Christie was always around and was a big part of my reading and watching as a child.
Do you remember a particular Christie that struck you when you were younger?
Yeah, I remember reading some of the big titles and not knowing that they were big titles.
Right, of course.
I think it was a little less obvious then. So I remember reading Murder on the Orient Express, and I must have been about 12. I've got a really strong memory, actually, that we went to see my godparents, who I didn't really know terribly well. And I was just sort of thinking all the way through the meetup, thinking, I wonder when we'll be done so that I can finish Murder on the Orient Express. And I remember when I was reading it, my mum kept saying, so who do you think it is? And I was telling her, you know, whoever I thought it was. And she was sort of with a little glint in her eye going, okay, obviously thinking he's really not got it. He's really not got it. And I really didn't get it. So it was quite a treat, really, to mix up, though. I think I read a lot of the lesser-known ones early. Why Didn't They Ask Evans was one of the first ones I read, I remember. Mm. So that's quite nice, really. And I always say to people now when they ask, which one should I read, depending on the type of reader they are, you know, whether I think they're going to read lots. But I generally say, don't go for one of the big ones first. Mm. Go for one of the really good ones. But if you've heard of it, basically don't go for that one, because save that, because they're likely to be ones that you get more out of if you read it later, once you know her style and her approach a little bit more.
Do you have one in particular that you typically suggest?
Yeah, I often suggest things like Peril at End House, Murder is Announced, Mrs. McGinty's Dead, which I love.
I love Mrs. McGinty's Dead.
Because that's really funny. And
it's so funny.
Yeah, I think that really works with people. And it's an absolutely solid mystery, but without that big, you know, genre-bending, twisting ending that you might get with her big classics. It's a solid ending that makes you go, "Ooh!"
Yeah.
But it's not, it's not rewriting the rules of mystery fiction. So those are often the ones that I recommend. Yeah, Peril at End House, Murder is Announced, and Mrs. McGinty's Dead.
Yeah.
But I tend to get a sense to what they are interested in and sort of steer them in that direction a little
bit.
Maybe they might like thrillers more or ones that superficially seem a little bit more cozy and nostalgic. Not that they really are, but...
It's so nice that you had that connection with your mom as well, that she was kind of reading alongside you or knew what was going on and can kind of chat with you about it.
Yeah, yeah. And we still do, you know, talk about things now. It's that weird thing that obviously I know a lot more about Agatha Christie now than she does, because I research endlessly it. Always, because there's so much to research. You know, she wrote so much and there's so much about her with things like adaptations that you just don't stop. And so it's been quite interesting, that sort of overtaking slightly of I'm suddenly the one who recognises things. But you also remember and note different things, don't you, as a reader?
Yeah.
It's interesting that characters or books or whatever that are memorable or stand out to you for some reason may well be ones that other people, they completely pass over and that they don't remember, or they didn't particularly stand out as a favourite for them. So different readers really do take different things from different Agatha Christie books, which is a huge part of her success, I think.
Completely. And we'll talk about this later. But for me, At Bertram's Hotel, which is the book we're talking about today, is one of those books where for me, it's just always been one that I love and I go back to a lot. But if I kind of bring it up in a group full of people who like Christie, you know, half of the people may not have even read it. It's just not kind of one of the most popular. But so you are an Agatha Christie historian, as you were just saying. You do talks, you write books, and you're a professor of screen histories at Solent University. Can you share a bit about what your work focuses on in particular with Christie and how you kind of came to that within your field?
So my first Agatha Christie book was Agatha Christie on Screen. And that came out of the fact that I'd actually done a little article and a talk about how some of the adaptations of her work link with questions of love and how love and sort of betrayal are on the screen. So it was just a little bit of fun. It was quite interesting that people really found that much more interesting, I think, than pretty much anything else I'd written. It was the thing that people were remembering and noticing. And as an academic, you really notice when people are talking to you about something you've written. So I thought, oh, that's interesting, because I love Agatha Christie, but I had deliberately not written about Agatha Christie up to that point because I love Agatha Christie, and it can kill your love for something, right? The more you make something into your work. And I was thinking about what I wanted to do next. And I was really thinking, I just would love to do a history of Agatha Christie on screen, because my background is that my undergraduate degree was English Literature and Film at the University of Southampton. And I stayed there to do an MA in film. And then my PhD was on the early days of British television. So a real mixture of sort of history, film and English.
Mm.
So a pretty good match, really, for what I wanted to do.
Apex, really.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll just do it. I'll bite the bullet and I'll go and I'll write this. And I did. And it was a huge amount of work, much more than I thought it would be. Massively satisfying, though.
Yay.
I was so... The thing I couldn't get over was that there is so much information out there once you do some digging, that is new. Like, we still have so much to learn. And it's not just me doing digging for Agatha Christie stuff by any means. There's a good dozen, if not more, amazing Agatha Christie scholars and researchers who are looking into all sorts of parts of her life, career, mm-hmm. legacy. And so once I wrote that book, Agatha Christie on Screen, I just found that I found so much more material that I thought, well, I'm not done. I really don't feel I'm done.
Yeah.
And the Agatha Christie estate was so supportive, and that they really found a lot of the stuff I was talking about quite interesting and helpful. And so I thought, well, Poirot is going to be 100 years old fairly soon at that point, because 1920 or 1921 in the UK.
And still a fully black mustache. It's amazing for 100.
Yes, I know, I know. Well, he's going to keep going. I mean, there's no way that Poirot will outlive all of us. Absolutely.
Of us.
And his mustache certainly will.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, maybe I could do the same sort of thing, but about everything Poirot. And I took it to HarperCollins, her publisher, and amazingly they said yes, as did Agatha Christie Limited, which gave me access to lots of great stuff. And that's, it's just kept going from then, really. And so I've just written the Marple book, so Poirot I was really happy with, and it did well. And so I wrote a Marple book, which is again a huge amount of work, but very satisfying.
Yeah.
And yes, so and there's still so much more. It doesn't
so
stop
much.
I literally have a list on my phone of maybe a dozen topics related to Agatha Christie that are on my one day list, one of which the Swinging Christies, but we'll come on to that.
We will. Well, I won't ask you about the list now, but maybe after we've done the podcast, you'll share the list, because that's it's so true. There is so much to dive into. There are so many facets. And part of that is just the volume of work she produced allows for us to explore so much. There are so many patterns to look into. And you've kind of started with that with your new podcast, which is called The Swinging Christies, about Agatha Christie in the 1960s. It's so much fun. It's so interesting. It's so well researched. Can you tell us a little bit about it and like what inspired the podcast?
So yeah, so yes, there is this thing about the quantity of work that Agatha Christie did, and that obviously opens up lots of avenues for discussing her from different angles. But also it's the way that she sort of hints at or goes into aspects of society that are really different all the way through her career. You know, she doesn't just stay with sort of stock characters we see time and time again. She actually is really embracing and talking about lots of things about the world. And so that means that as well as there being a lot of material, there are lots of different ways to discuss that material.
Yeah.
And I'd always felt that the 1960s was really underappreciated for sure, but really sort of under discussed, what's the word, like we're just not spoken about very much.
Yeah.
And it's actually commercially probably her most successful decade. You know, her books were selling more each year than the previous
sure.
one. I mean, since then, I'm sure it's all leveled out, and we've still got, you know, And Then There Were None, certainly right at the top. But in terms of year by year, she was doing really, really well, and things
yeah.
like her movies, the MGM stuff. And I was starting to notice that when I was doing things like documentaries, and this isn't a jibe at any particular documentary at all, but
yeah.
they tend to want to talk about the 1920s, 1930s, and maybe the Second World War. And
yeah.
then it sort of ends. And then it's like, oh, in 1976, she died. And I was like, but there's this whole period
right.
where
she was writing until the moment she died.
Yeah. yeah. And I think, and maybe we'll talk about this with Bertrand Sotel. I don't know if you agree with me, Rebecca, but I think a lot of people don't realise that she was writing contemporary fiction all the time.
Yes.
I think that they think she was always writing about the 1930s or something.
Right.
And you're like, no, Third Girl, for example, is absolutely a swinging
absolutely.
60s text.
Yes.
You know, the Mirror Cracked opens with discussions of new housing development.
The development, of course. Yeah.
The development.
The
with a
development.
D.
Capital D. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
No, I completely agree with you. And I think that just because she has characters that may have had kind of their youth in a particular period doesn't mean that the context of the book is kind of older.
Yeah.
She's very, very good at letting characters exist in a time that is maybe a little bit beyond them. I mean, Poirot is basically from his beginning a retired man, kind of having to deal with a world in which he is less and less relevant. And I think a lot of the pattern that I see throughout her book is kind of the idea of waning relevance and how we deal with this as human beings in our own lives and kind of looking around at the world that we live in.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, there is this thing about, well, you're absolutely right that Poirot is always out of his time, really, even when we meet him in 1915. But the way that the characters speak to him change and reflects the way that society's changed. So there is this bit, where people start to say how old he is in the 1960s and sort of not in the way that perhaps is revered or, given the respect that we might deserve, but almost like, well, you're really out of your time here. And Ariadne Oliver, many of our favourites, many of us, I'm sure, have her as one of our favourite characters. Mm-hmm. But she, really sort of not quite understanding bits of society, but still engaging with it, still not wanting to be out of touch. But that doesn't mean that she understands it. And I think that there is this thing that sometimes you can read these books and you can see that Agatha Christie is thinking, I don't like this, or this is an asset of society I'm not very keen on. I don't like this type of, person in society, or the way that society is seen in this particular way. But she always acknowledges that this is something that happens as you get older, right? Yeah. It's true of all of us. It's true of me. I'm in my early 40s and I have wonderful students. I'm really pleased. But the way that they live their lives sometimes, the way that they're engaged with their screens and everything, and the way that everything is completely baffling to me in lots of ways. That doesn't mean that they're wrong and I was right. I'm sure I'd be exactly the same. So it's interesting that she knows that is something that as you get older, it's inevitably, I think, going to be the way that you consider about stuff, that it doesn't seem quite right to you or slightly baffling to you. But that doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means you don't quite get it. And that's all right.
That's okay. And I think she does such a great job of that throughout her books. But I think the 60s is so ripe for that in particular, because it was a time of such social change that was very kind of in your face in a lot of ways. And it was much more widely broadcast across the world. And so I think the way she deals with it in her books in the 60s is a little bit more, she takes the bull by the horns a little bit more with that. How do you feel that her work in the 60s is kind of different from the rest of her work?
So, yes, this is where I give huge credit to Gray Rob Brown, who's my co-host, co-producer. We both work on the Swinging Christies. And he is brilliant at uncovering context and stuff. So, we both do our obviously reading and research around each topic. But he's particularly strong at finding stuff and saying, this is happening in society and we can sort of see this reflected here in what Agatha Christie is writing. And so whenever either of us are finding things like that, stuff that's changing, including stuff like, the way that attitudes to sex is changing, such as, the pill, for example, things like the fear of the nuclear bomb, spoken about really casually, by the way, in lots of the 1966 almost. It's a bit of a joke. I all got to worry about the bomb, whilst you're doing your dishes or something. But there's this thing that I think so much is changing quite quickly in the 1960s.
Right. Correct.
The pace of it is so different that I don't think you really get. Perhaps the war, as Second World War, slowing things down a little bit around that period for wider society because its ramifications are so strong. And we see that in stuff like A Murderer's Announced, which is very post-war, very much about Britain rebuilding itself and rethinking itself just after the Second World War. But I think that's sort of a bit slow. But the 60s is suddenly happening really quickly. And I think that is why it's quite interesting to see how she reflects that in her 1960s books, which she does in differing ways, some much more so than others.
I absolutely agree. We're going to talk about a Miss Marple book today, which was published in 65. And Christie kind of took a semi-break from Marple in the 30s and 40s. Instead, she was focusing on Poirot, and then she picks back up with Marple in the 50s to a degree, but more so in the late 50s and 60s. What do you think it is about Miss Marple that kind of re-interested Christie at that time? And other than the obvious, obviously, like, Poirot was selling really well, so she was writing more Poirot books. But, like, in terms of kind of coming back to Miss Marple and saying, like, this is a character I want to explore in this time period.
Yes, I it's funny. It's something that I've had a conversation with John Curran about more than once, where you know, we would love to find that sort of piece of paper or something that really explains this gap.
Yeah, dear reader.
But I think... Yeah, it's exactly. If anyone's found it, do let us know. But there is some, I think it's quite straightforward, which is that Agatha Christie was always very keen to say, I'm not Miss Marple, I'm much more like Ariadne Oliver, although not in all respects and various things. But actually, by the time we get to the 60s, she is starting to merge with Miss Marple a bit. And there's a whole bit in Bertram's Hotel where Miss Marple's memories are actually Agatha Christie's memories. Mm. The sort of whole thing about driving to a matinee in a four-wheeler and coffee creams and so I think that's stuff about Army and Navy stores and stuff. This is in her autobiography as well as in at Bertram's Hotel. And I'm not the first person to point out, by the way, you know, several biographers have. Mm-hmm. So there does seem to be a point where perhaps Miss Marple is a bit more of a comforting figure for her, that she's someone who... she can slip into the mindset of a little bit more readily. And I don't want to obviously speak on her behalf, but it seems like there is more of an overlap, a link there than there perhaps had been before. Because when she's first writing Miss Marple, she's 37 years old, something like that. So there's a massive difference between that and being in your 70s and writing Miss Marple. So there's bound to be a slight difference there. I would also say that there's something about the fact that by the time we get to the 60s, she's writing far fewer pure puzzle mysteries, which require a lot more work and are much more like Poirot, for example, would solve generally more puzzle mysteries, whereas Miss Marple is driven much more by instinct.
Yeah.
And so, again, we may discuss this in a minute about Bertram's, but certainly instinct is an important way that she solves lots of her crimes. And so... perhaps as she was writing more novels like that, Miss Marple tended to be a better fit by someone who instinctively understood how characters might operate in relation to each other and so on.
Mm. I think that's absolutely right. I also think it's a bit of a call to relevance of, you know, I kind of empathize or understand this woman. And a lot of Miss Marple's power is in her ability to be invisible. And as you become an older woman, you start to feel invisible. And I think Agatha Christie was not only empathizing with that, but saying, like, but look what we can still do.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that there's also this thing, though, about Miss Marple wanting her independence to still be respected. I love one of my favorite recurring themes in Bertram's is that she wants to be able to get the bus.
Yes.
She doesn't want a taxi called for her. Thank you very much.
Right.
And so this idea of actually, yes, respect is lovely, but also respect includes actually listening to and honoring what an older lady might want and not thinking for her. Which is something, if you've gone through as much Agatha Christie correspondence as I have, she certainly doesn't want people thinking for her. So, you know, if someone's writing a blurb or putting together a cover design and haven't spoken to her before, you've got a pretty good chance that she's going to say no to it. It's much better that you speak to her first. And quite right, too. Best-selling novelist in the world. Why wouldn't you? She knows what she's doing.
Correct. I think this is a great moment to segue into our novel, which is At Bertram's Hotel. We've said it a few times. I'm just going to do a little brief historical note here, and then we're going to dive into the book. At Bertram's Hotel is a Miss Marple mystery published in the UK in 1965 and the US in 1966. It is the 10th novel in which Miss Marple appears, not including short stories or short story collections. And while At Bertram's Hotel is not considered one of her kind of essential or big works, it was generally well liked upon publication, particularly for its sharp cultural eye and the creation of a hotel atmosphere. The hotel at the center of the story, Bertram's Hotel, is believed to be based on Fleming's Mayfair Hotel, although it has also been asserted that she based the descriptions on Brown's Hotel, known for being the first hotel in London, where Christie often stayed. Now, both of these hotels, by the way, are still standing today if you want to have a very comfortable stay somewhere in Mayfair. And I will say that both hotels have on their website that they are the inspiration for Bertram's Hotel. So, although I will say Fleming's is a little bit more... says it could be us, it could also be Browns. Browns takes all the credit for themselves. So that's that. You know, history is whatever you make of it, I suppose. At Bertram's Hotel was adapted for BBC Film in 1987 with Joan Hickson as Miss Marple and Caroline Blackiston as Bess Sedgwick. In my opinion, the best take on such a fabulous character. And it was also adapted for BBC Radio and for ITV with Geraldine McEwen in 2007. I am so excited to talk about this book with you. Mark, please give us a 1 minute or so synopsis of At Bertram's Hotel.
Cool. Well, we join Miss Marple, who's just had her adventures in the Caribbean, and she's going to take another holiday now, courtesy of nephew Raymond, who initially is thinking maybe Bournemouth. Marple does not want to go to Bournemouth. She wants the bustling sights of London. And wants to stay at Bertram's Hotel, which both Raymond and his wife aren't entirely sure might still exist, but it does, because it's such an old-fashioned establishment that Miss Marple had very much enjoyed in her younger days. When Miss Marple goes to Bertram's Hotel, she's delighted but a bit surprised to see that actually things don't seem to have changed that much in the intervening years. And actually perhaps even starts to be a bit suspicious of the fact that it's a bit strange. This hotel seems to be so much stuck in its time. We slowly sort of discover that things indeed are not perhaps quite what they seem, and that certainly some of the hotel guests seem to be caught up in some sort of criminal activity, which might be linked to a mail robbery, a mail train robbery, I should say. Maybe, very possibly. But some of the most notable guests, Canon Pennyfather, who I love, who unfortunately is one of many Agatha Christie characters to be coshed on the head at some point because he returns unexpectedly one night. But there's also, yes, Bess Sedgwick, who's this sort of adventurer, just has done everything imaginable that is really exciting. Saving children from burning houses, I think, is one thing at one point. she's there, but so is her estranged daughter, Elvira or Elvira. They both also competing for the attention of the same man, who's an Italian racing car driver. So really exciting dynamic lives we're having there. And eventually there's a murder, but it's not clear whether the murder victim was the intended target or not.
That was perfect.
Oh, good.
I was giggling along. I was nodding my head. I loved it.
It's not an easy book to synopsize, because
it's not.
Once it's one of those things that once you get to the end and you peel away the bits that are important and less important, it's a bit of a giveaway actually what's going on once you realize where it's going. But
yeah,
it's atmosphere. You know, it's not a puzzle mystery. It's about this wonderful atmosphere and the characters.
Honestly, and the murder comes so late, and you kind of go like, eh. Like
I
don't even need.
Oh, there will be a murder. That's like, it's really not that important. The murder. I mean, to your enjoyment of the book, I don't think the murder is that significant, really. Either you like it or you don't. I don't think the murder will make much difference either way.
I completely agree. It could have totally focused on the use of the hotel and the kind of robberies going on in that interaction, and it would have been totally fine without that murder. So. I personally am a huge fan of this book. I squealed when you chose it because I was just desperate for someone to eventually choose this book. Everyone's like, I'll do Death on the Nile. I'm like, no, no more. So I was very excited. Why did you choose this book?
So I knew it had to be a 60s Marple book.
Sure.
Because I'm doing, you know, with Grey, the Swinging Christies, and the Marple. And so I've been so immersed, this sort of, yeah, you say that the overlap between those is so strong. And this is, of all the books from the 60s, and maybe of all the Miss Marple books, the one that has gone up the most in my estimation when I reread it for both projects. Because I don't think it's one of her masterpieces. I it's not that I think that it is a flawless, amazing book.
No.
But it's a book that I get huge amounts of pleasure from. And the more that I read it, the more pleasure I take from it. It is beautifully written.
Yes,
the
it is.
Opening is phenomenal. Oh. This absolutely. I've got it here. I don't know if you mind if I
please
read out the very. So the opening is.
Let me just close my eyes. Hold on. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, yes, you need to, because it's so evocative. So, in the heart of the West End, there are many quiet pockets unknown to almost all. But taxi drivers who traverse them with expert knowledge and arrive triumphantly thereby at Park Lane, Berkeley Square, or South Audley Street. If you turn off on an unpretentious street from the park and turn left and right once or twice, you will find yourself in a quiet street with Bertram's Hotel on the right-hand side. Bertram's Hotel has been there a long time. During the war, houses were demolished on the right of it and a little farther down on the left of it, but Bertram's itself remained unscathed. I mean, that's just amazing already. I mean, she goes on and on about how it hasn't changed. But we know that she's telling us, she's literally guiding us with, as you say, close your eyes. A bit difficult if you're reading it. If you're having an audiobook, close your eyes. And you're guided there. You know exactly what she's talking about. And this goes on for ages. And she talks about inside, if this was the first time you visited Bertram's, it feels like a vanished world. And, you know, I'm tempted just to stop here. Maybe we'll just read the book real quick.
Can we just go back and read? I know. And I just, you're so right. That beginning is so beautiful. It's almost J.M. Barrie, and it's kind of like whimsicality, nostalgia. There's a fairy tale quality to it. And the way she talks about the feeling of nostalgia and kind of where it kind of meets up against reality is so profound and really feels like Christy coming through. Coming through Marple, which is not something I always feel. You've talked about this in your podcast, kind of people putting words in Christie's mouth. But I do think that beginning, it feels like she's talking about what the passage of time feels like.
Yes, absolutely. And I think what I find really interesting about it is that not just with Bertram's, and I'm not going to spoil other books from this decade, but as a general point, you may expect that somebody who is discussing nostalgia is therefore saying, oh, so old is good and new is bad.
Correct.
But we get a really interesting selection of villains in the 60s, some of whom are very much of the old traditional school. You know, we have middle-aged and older women as, you know, as villains, just as much as we have young men who seem to be, you know, very into their fashion. There's a real, real mix there. And we've got stories like, I don't think this is too much of a spoiler to say that in Halloween Party, your teenage boys are actually people who help to sort of solve the crime and save the day at the end of it. And so there's a real thing there about, yes, nostalgia is great. And there's absolutely no problem through Agatha Christie that she's clearly enjoying remembering the past when she was so happy and so much happiness there as well. But that isn't the same as her saying, oh, we should go back to that.
Right.
That everything since then has been bad. Instead, it's nostalgia placed in exactly the right position, if you ask me, which is a lovely little window into another world. But you can't ever go back there, and you should never want to go back there because it's just impossible. That's not how the world works.
Yeah, and if someone's trying to take you back there, be suspicious.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Always be suspicious in Agatha Christie's world anyway.
Of course. I mean, Miss Marple is the most suspicious person, which I think Chief Inspector Davy says at some point. He's like, you don't think people are very good, do you? Let's talk a little bit about Bess Sedgwick, because I just think she's one of the all-time great kind of one-off Christie female characters. I put her in line kind of like Lydia Lee is another favorite character for me, Marina Gregg. A handful of others. Tell me how you feel about her as a character and kind of what she brings to this story, particularly in the context of her being like a woman, a modern woman of the 1960s.
Yes, I think it's really interesting that when I read Bertram's Hotel, and actually even when I reread it, I always sort of slightly expect there to be a little bit of a more traditional, I guess, discussion of or development of her character. Because with this thing of her being estranged from her daughter, I remember that the first time I read it, are we allowed to say spoilers here?
You absolutely are allowed to. Yes, we'll just note that there's a spoiler.
There is definitely a spoiler, which is that when I read it, and even when I've read it since, I sort of am always expecting to learn that they're in league with each other. Right. I always expect it to be that actually they've been really close for a long time and it's all been set up between them.
Yeah.
And that it was all just because we've seen this in, and I won't spoil other books, but definitely other books where you think people either don't get along or they haven't spoken for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then you discover that actually they've been in it together and that they're the villains. Yeah. I always am expecting that to happen. But actually, no, Bess just isn't really that bothered about her daughter. And as we find out towards the end, of course, there are things that she will do for her daughter, but not the traditional maternal stuff.
No.
she's never going to go back to that. She's not that sort of a mother.
Yeah.
And I think that is so fascinating that she's not a maternal figure, but she is still protective. And this whole thing about part of her being protective is her basically saying, you don't want me hanging around as your mother. Yeah. That actually it's much better for other people to look after you. And that is hell of a thing.
Yeah.
For that to be the way that you basically communicate with your daughters, to say, you're better off without me, don't worry, and to really, really mean it. And I think she's probably right. But that's not what you expect from this character. So I find that really fascinating.
Yeah.
But yeah, how about you though, Rebecca? Why did you find her so fascinating? Is it that she's so adventurous? Is that what you loved about her?
Well, I mean, we don't really get to see that much of her adventures, to be honest. We hear about them.
No.
But I think it's the joy for life that she has. I mean, that first scene where we see her and she's eating a jelly donut and the jelly is dripping down her chin. It's an iconic moment, right? And she's laughing this big laugh. And there's just something so... I think she's the kind of woman you would expect Miss Marple to have a lot of judgments about. And yet she is completely non-judgmental about kind of the lifestyle she leads and the way she has dealt with her daughter. And in fact, later on towards the end, she says, you know, I thought I was too dangerous for my daughter. Maybe I played it wrong. Maybe that was the wrong thing to do. So she has this capacity for regret and for reflection, but she doesn't kind of take back anything she's done. She's just completely authentically herself in a completely modern way. She takes lovers, young men as lovers. She's still in love with her, you know, her husband who's died and has kept his name. And she's adventurous, but she's also got a lot of vulnerability in her.
Yeah.
And I think that vulnerability that she kind of shares openly in almost a brazen way is kind of what makes her so interesting. She's not harsh. She's just different than everybody else.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that we're both really saying that she's real, right?
Yeah.
That she's got a complex character like a real person is, that people can be bad, with, you know, air quotes, in some ways, and good in others.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's absolutely true of Beth, that there's things that she would, you know, she will save children from a burning building, but she'll also happily be a bit of a criminal mastermind, and she'll, shimmy up a drain pipe to escape the police if that's what's needed.
And I, part of me wondered in kind of that last scene whether Christy felt an affinity with her as well, because she says, I turned my mind to crime. I thought it was so interesting. And that's what Christy does. I mean, she's turned her mind to crime. She is not carrying out the crimes. She's writing them down. But, you know, there's a little bit, I think, of Christy saying, like, the exploration of crime is actually kind of an interesting and intellectual pursuit. And I'm doing it, too.
Yeah. Yeah, she does. And she as Christy mentioned in a few interviews like that, one of her early ones just before she went on her grand tour in 1922. She gave an interview where she said, "If crime is like drugs, once you start it," because she just was, finding that it's something that she was returning to time and time again.
Yeah.
And in fact, you think about how being an adventurer like Beth Sedgwick, famously surfing and seeing the world, and even later on in her life, obviously getting the Orient Express by herself and traveling and doing whatever she wanted to do.
Yeah.
She was a strong, independent woman who absolutely did what she wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I think there are some neat parallels there. Yeah.
Who also had a complex relationship to motherhood, I think.
Yes, definitely. Yes, in both ways, both as a daughter and as a mother.
Exactly. And I think Elvira is also an interesting character to me, because even though she's the younger, there is something much less modern about her than her mother, which I think is an interesting twist as well within kind of the generational divide of the book.
Yes, I think that's true. But I think that's also a bit of the traditional thing of the child rejecting their parents' approach, whichever way it may be.
Right.
So if you've got an outlandish parent in some way, then you might reject that and be different in another way.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that there's something really interesting about the fact that these are characters that exist independently, both of our own best, but we learn so much about them because of the way that they interact or don't interact,
yeah.
I guess, or their sort of relationship between each other
mm.
is such a big indication as to the type of people that they are.
Yeah.
And I think, truthfully, whether you find that interesting or not is a really big indication as to whether a Bertram's Hotel is for you.
That's so true.
And I can absolutely understand why people would say, why do I care about Bertram's Hotel? The murder's not for ages. The crime is sort of quite vague for quite a long time.
I know.
A cannon gets knocked over the head.
Poor Cannon Pennyfather, the best name in the business.
Oh, amazing. And I think the characters are so strong generally yeah. in Bertram's Hotel. Some of my favourite characters, we only see sort of once. I love the... So I'm getting onto another topic.
Please,
now.
Please, go, go.
But this thing about that, either you love the characters or you don't. You know, if you're into the characters. But there's the doctor who tends
yes.
to Cannon Pennyfather.
Yes, who's been doing abortions.
No longer.
Yeah.
He's been struck off. And now he's sort of really grumpy, but he's there and he's this fully rounded character.
Mm-hmm.
And you think there's no reason for Agatha Christie to make him this fully rounded character
mm-hmm.
In terms of the novel, the plotting, right?
Yeah.
There's no reason for that. But she's absolutely come up with this person who I could picture right now. I know exactly what he looks like. I know exactly how
Same.
He speaks.
Yep.
He's so, so well expressed.
Mm-hmm.
And not really that important to the plot, but,
right.
but the texture that we get from that
mm-hmm.
and there's also the jeweler or the
yes.
pawnbroker or you know that I was reading that section going again there is a way that you could just you know who cares this character isn't really that significant to the storyline
right.
and yet we get sort of inner thoughts we get a little bit of an understanding as to way that he's reacting
right.
to Elvira in particular
yeah.
but also generally day to day really nice little bits of character insight that don't advance the plot, but make it such a pleasure to read.
Correct.
So again, if that's the sort of thing that people love from their Agatha Christie, then Bertram's is a great choice.
Yeah.
But if you want lots of clues and a puzzle to solve, then I can understand that Bertram's is not going to be top of your list of Agatha Christie favourites.
No, I think that's completely right. It's very character-driven. It's very atmospheric. And in fact, a lot of the characters are kind of just atmosphere. In a way, Miss Gorringe, I think is how you pronounce it, is just like this wonderful set piece of a receptionist.
Mm.
The same with Henry, the kind of butler man who's serving everyone and brings like endless muffins, it would seem, to people. So I think you're completely right. And it's why it appeals to me. For me, this is when people talk about a comfort book, that is what this is for me. I just feel like I'm about to sit in one of those huge chairs in the lobby at Bertram's Hotel. That's what this book feels like to me, you know,
yeah.
Fully ensconced yeah. in kind of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And to that end, I also think Chief Inspector Davy is a really interesting character. And I wonder whether you think that maybe he was meant to be a repeat character because she takes a lot of time developing him.
Yes, that's interesting. I don't know because I think that for me, that's a bit of an indication of the fact that characters generally are really important
yeah.
in this book. And that actually she did say at other points that you can have detectives pretty much dropped in, as in sort of the police detectives,
yeah.
dropped in and just swap their names around and it doesn't really matter. But here we want to get a little bit more of depth. And we do get a bit of that in some of her other 60s books.
Yeah.
Mirror Cracked has
mm-hmm.
got stuff
yep.
as well. But I don't know... I don't know how much we can think that she was actually thinking to bring them back, but
yeah.
that just that the characterization is going to be really important. That
yeah.
just didn't want, you know, I can imagine that she just didn't want someone who could be any old police, you know, policeman.
Yeah.
She wanted somebody who had a bit more depth to them.
Yeah.
And that really works here.
It does. And just the element with Chief Inspector Davy also of kind of underestimation, which, you know, is present for throughout, you know, Marple's books, but also in the context of Bertram's Hotel as well. Like nothing is quite as what it appears to be. And Chief Inspector Davy is the same. He kind of comes in pretending to be a rube. And that's his whole vibe is like, I'm a big dum-dum until eventually he pins down what's going on. So I think that's kind of a runner throughout this book as well.
Yes, and I love it when Agatha Christie really embraces a particular theme. You know, that there is something that in her book, that there are books where there are multiple discussions of one particular aspect. And this whole thing, about things initially seeming to be one thing but actually being something else.
Right.
We can, it is obviously hugely important to tell. But I also think that you get much more out of that the second or even third time that you read the book. That it's always funny to me to hear anybody saying, oh, why would you reread an Agatha Christie when you know you've done it?
Right.
And I'm sort of like, well, I'm not saying it's the least interesting thing in her books, because absolutely not. But if you think that that's the whole reason, just go and buy a crossword. You know,
right.
Like, if you just want to know the solution to something,
the
journey is just as much fun. And she understood that.
Yeah.
And John Curran has seen through his analysis of her notebooks, and amazing work by John, by the way, because I've gone through those notebooks, and the way he's made sense of them is a phenomenal piece of work, because they are not easy to navigate. But he's pointed out that she didn't always start with the ending anyway, and often didn't, and often changed her mind about who might have done it in lots of her books, because that wasn't always the most important thing. It was the story, the journey. Those tend to be the things that I think really drove her more than anything else, perhaps.
Absolutely. I mean, there are books of hers that I love where I feel like the person who did it is a bit of a, like a womp womp, you know. I feel that way about, for example, An Appointment with Death for me is a total womp womp ending. But I love that book. I reread it a lot. It's, I think,
well, there's
Yeah.
So I just say that I think that maybe the most famous one is Murder in Mesopotamia.
Yeah.
Where, either you're on board with that ending or you're not. I am absolutely not.
You're not? Okay, and why?
No, because it requires a leap of belief that the characters would act in a way that really is so phenomenally, I'm not going to say stupid, that's unfair, but let's just say that they're not paying attention to the fundamentals of their life.
Right, the idea that you could would forget the person you married is like so crazy.
That's what I was saying. Yeah. I didn't want to spoil it, but that's it. And so for me, that is a really rare occasion where I'm like, oh, now it really doesn't work for me.
Okay.
But if you sort of gave that to me, if it was like Agatha Christie's unfinished manuscript and you scrubbed out those last three chapters, what an amazing book that is. Because it's, you know, the Amy Leatherin writing it, really
great voice.
Evocative stuff. So yeah, maybe that's how I'll read it next time. Maybe I'll just stop before the end.
Yeah, why not? once we know the end, we can just kind of enjoy the ride of it. And, you know, the reveal is what it is. And you can kind of enjoy Poirot's, big pointing moment and let it go at that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So for me, At Bertram's Hotel is a really great setting for Miss Marple. Just as herself. And it also has kind of a subversive undertone to it. Let's talk a little bit about the setting and kind of how the book plays with that. For example, the idea of like a place of comfort actually being this den of iniquity. Do you think that is kind of speaks to something she was maybe exploring in terms of what was going on socially at the time?
Yeah, I think it's definitely this thing about not taking things at face value.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it happens to be Bertram's Hotel here is, I'm not going to say irrelevant, but it, like, it almost, you could transplant that to a lot of places. Like we've just seen with A Caribbean Mystery that superficially, characters who might superficially be the most welcoming or be the ones who are doing the best for our lead characters are not necessarily those that are to be trusted. But that's always been the case.
Yeah.
That you... And how often is the doctor, you know, in a story ends up being the villain? Because it's often people who you might trust superficially, or you might think, oh, well, why would they or how could they? Well, that's because they're human. And with Bertram's Hotel, it's the same sort of principle, but I guess transferred to a building, which is, well, this is a nice old building and Miss Marple's been here before. Just like you might have a character who meets an old friend. You know, I'm always suspicious in a murder mystery, not so much Agatha Christie, but when someone's old friend pops up in episode 12 or something for an episode, I'm always like, oh, they're going to have done it. And invariably they have, because this is such a good thing, right? That superficially you think this place or this person are one thing.
Yeah.
And it really pulls the rug out of you, to say, out from under you, to say, oh, well, actually, Bertram's just playing a part here, mm-hmm. right? It's a character just as much as any of the humans, yeah. that it's making you think it's one thing, but actually it's very much yeah. something else.
And it's even multiple things at the same time. I mean, I thought it was so interesting, but also funny, the way she described the rooms the Americans get versus the ones the British get, and the way that they're given yeah. different breakfasts. And they're given different amenities, and yeah. you know, it's. I think that's kind of her starting to dive into what are when people come to the UK, what are they expecting? What do we present yeah. ourselves at versus what are we actually? And so that's I think another kind of thing that she brushes up against with this book that I found really profound, and she does it in such a subtle way that it doesn't feel forced down your throat, but I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point, and it's almost a natural extension of this post-war
yes,
Britain
yes.
having a great big wobble, wondering where are we in the world mm-hmm. now, and Bertram's and lots of other things, including stuff for tourists, which you still see now in mm-hmm. London. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sorry to say that I do sometimes go through London and you think that's for the Americans, just as, you know, you might get for any country in the world. Of course,
sure,
got lots
sure.
of people coming from another country. You can have people, you know, things set up for that. Dare I even say the mousetrap is probably kept going through tourism much more than through anything else,
I'm
because
sure
it's
true.
A British institution.
Right.
Maybe the mousetrap is the modern day Bertrams.
Oh my God.
Because it's this idea that yeah. you're conjuring up this view of Britain that people really like to indulge in, but mm-hmm. that hasn't been around for quite a long time and perhaps never had. It's this really interesting thing, and I don't have the book to hand, but I know that Julius Green, in his book about Agatha Christie plays, talks about the thing, and I hadn't really thought about it before, but with the mousetrap, at some point you have to decide whether you're making it period or not, right?
Yes.
Because it starts yeah. being set, obviously, in the 1950s,
yeah.
but what happens in about 1970, like, because in like 1955, you're presumably setting it in 1955 because
right.
it's only been running a few years. Mm-hmm. But then by the time you get a few years after that, you have to decide, is actually this being set in the modern day still mm-hmm. as time rumbles on, or are you setting it in the past? And
yeah.
it's the same sort of thing with Bertrams here, that Bertrams is absolutely saying, oh, people want the past, whether it's a real past or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're going to pay for it, we're going to give it to them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and in that way, Christie and Shakespeare's plays have that in common. You know, it's like you have to choose. Do you take the conceptual elements of the play or do you take the setting of the play? And I think that's exactly right. I mean, I once saw Julius Caesar underwater. So I can say sometimes the setting.
Were you underwater?
I was not underwater. They did the play as though they were underwater and like swam everywhere. It was one of the craziest.
That sounds really tiring. I thought you'd be one hell of a swimmer you would need to be.
It was one of the craziest, but they also, I spoke to someone after who'd been in the play and they said it was one of the ways of taking away the element of time, because underwater we didn't have to discuss what time we were in. It was like, oh my God,
that's quite
crazy.
Sweet.
but I think that's an aside, but that's so interesting. And I think that's totally right about The Mousetrap and any of her plays, because there are just truisms that you can take throughout any time period and make it work, just depending on how you set it, really. So the ending of this book is like fairly abrupt and one of the rare Christies where the killer is not brought to justice. Do you wish we had gotten to see Chief Inspector Davy pursue Elvira, or do you kind of like where it ends?
No, I don't know that I would want to see the pursuit. What I would have liked to have seen was a bit of evidence, or, you know, something that would really put the seal on it.
Yeah.
And certainly the Joan Hickson adaptation, it's a real cliche, but they find the diary, I seem to remember, where
lots
of the stuff is revealed, which is, you know, that's not a brilliant ending, but you do, I think, need a little bit of something. But I've got to say, because of the type of book it is, I'm not sure you particularly notice, because it's about getting the sense of it there. But it's interesting that this ending, when Good Housekeeping in America picked it up for serialization, this was a request for them was for that to be changed to make Elvira more sympathetic and have a sense that she might be rehabilitated in some way. That was a big request of theirs, and I can understand, because it is quite an abrupt ending. Like, it does feel like there is something else that perhaps is missing from it. It doesn't bother me hugely, but I think that if I were the editor at the time, I might have asked for something to clarify the evidence, or to perhaps seal our characters a little bit more. But I'm perfectly happy with it. I don't know how much it bothered you, Rebecca. Do you think that? What was your thoughts about that?
I couldn't say it bothers me, but it brought to mind like the end of the Murder on the Orient Express, where there's just kind of this like slamming of the fist on the table, kind of, and and I like a little wrap up. What can I say? Like, I wouldn't have minded a chapter later with Chief Inspector Davy visiting Miss Marple in St. Mary Mead and telling her the story of how he caught Elvira. You know,
that's nice. Yes, no, I agree. That would have been lovely. That's great. Shall we just write it really quick?
Yeah, do you want to do that? Beautiful.
Yeah, we'll put an hour to one side.
And I can just imagine, like, Cherry Baker would be vacuuming and he's trying to tell the story and he can't hear because, you know, I can just see it all happening, and him trying to kind of fit into her sitting room, which is very small, and he's this big man. And I can just see it happening, and I would have loved that scene.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, that's really good. Oh, I love that.
Because
actually, this is one that she didn't make a lot of changes to. It didn't go through a lot of changes. There are some. I mean, the mirror cracked. She had to rework quite a lot because everybody worked out the solution, which really affected its serialization chances. And things like Nemesis, that I was going through not long ago, and that has got huge amounts of added material after it had been typed up that she hand wrote and stuff like that. So she was making changes when she felt they were necessary, but clearly for Bertram's she didn't. She was clearly happy with it, and yeah, quite right too, if you ask me.
I agree, and it just goes to show the book, as you've said previously, is not about the puzzle, it's not about the murder, it's really about the atmosphere and about the characters, and I think on those fronts we can be totally satisfied with it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that it works as a novel, and sometimes you've got to read them as just a novel, and not an Agatha Christie.
Correct.
And I think that you, if you take your expectations of what you think is going to be in an Agatha Christie, you may well get a lot more out of this book, but also perhaps have even more respect for Agatha Christie once you finish, when you realise the type of thing that she was writing, as well as her amazing puzzles.
I agree. This has been so much fun, Mark. Thank you so, so much for being here. I hope you've had a good time as well, talking about
that. Oh, it's been wonderful. Hotel. Thank you.
Oh, good. Would you like to be found by the people? And if so, where can they find you on any platform?
Oh, yes, please. Yes, do find me. my personal accounts on X and Instagram are at Dr. Mark Aldridge, but you can also find the Swinging Christies at Christie_time on both of those as well.
Yep.
So, that's where you can find me.
Absolutely. And we'll have links to those, as well as the links to your books in the episode notes. So everybody go and check those out. And thank you so much again for being here, Mark. And I really appreciate it. This was just the most fun I've had since getting pneumonia. Definitely.
Thank you.
And I hope you feel better as well with your cold.
Yeah. Thank you. And you.
I'm working on it. I'm working on it. But thank you so much. And let's stay in touch and have a lovely night. This podcast is produced by Kate Kreshal with sound engineering by Winter Robinson. This was the final episode of season 2, and we are so grateful that you're here listening with us. We have a mini episode coming up in between seasons, and then we'll be back in May. Stay up to date on our Instagram at @TeaAndMurder. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.